Sound the trump in Zion. Raise the alarm on my holy mountain. Let everyone tremble in fear, because the day of the Lord is upon us. It is a day of darkness and gloom, a day of thick clouds and deep blackness. But suddenly, like dawn spreading across the mountains, a great and mighty army appears. Nothing like it has been seen before or will ever be seen again. Fire burns in front of them, and flames follow after them. Ahead of them lies the land, as beautiful as the Garden of Eden. Behind them is nothing but desolation. Not one thing escapes. They look like horses. They charge forward like war horses. Look at them as they leap along the mountaintops. Listen to the noise they make, like the rumbling of chariots, like the roar of fire sweeping across a field of stubble, or like a mighty army moving into battle. Fear grips all the people. Every face grows pale with terror. The attackers march like warriors and scale city walls like soldiers. Straight forward they march, never breaking rank. They never jostle each other. Each moves in exactly the right position. They break through the defenses without missing a step. They swarm over the city and run along its walls. They enter all the houses, climbing like thieves through the windows. The earth quakes as they advance, and the heavens tremble. The sun and moon grow dark, and the stars no longer shine. The Lord is at the head of the column. He leads them with a shout. This is His mighty army, and they follow His orders. Hey there, Patriots. I'm so glad you're back with me. I hope you guys are ready for more of this amazing history that we are learning about right here. It is Trump's War. This is part two. If you haven't seen part one, I would encourage you to go back and see Trump's War part one. This is going to be part two, starting with McKinley and moving forward from there. The other one, we talked more about Lincoln in that period of time. And what I didn't really talk about, and I do want to say real quick, and actually first let's go ahead and do this. Hit the like button, everybody, and we're going to go ahead and get started. Hit like and share and subscribe always. Make sure your bell is rung so you'll be notified when we do new videos. And also this is my website right here, melissaredpill.com, melissaredpill.com. You can see all of the videos that we have done sorted by our wonderful team, Melly, and also the great information we have about health. We are seeing people getting well right and left. Very exciting. Here's all the social media right here. Here are my end times books, and here are the audiobooks right here. Now, let's get started. I did not really go into on the last video about, you know, the one that we are most familiar with, which is King George. And there is King George himself right there. And I just wanted to just say, bring this out, because, you know, that was way back in 1776, and we were trying to get out from under these criminals that have been running the world and doing all this evil to the world. Okay, so we had that, and then I wanted you to see that. I wanted you to see the family line, but I just wanted you to see something. It just, okay, we never really looked at any of these things before. At least I didn't. Okay, maybe you did. But okay, let me see if I can find the clip. So this is him as a young person, right? Supposedly, that's what he looked like. And then here it's, this is the story. This is the story. It says he was smitten with Lady Sarah Lennox right here. That was who he was smitten with. But they, you know, he couldn't marry who he wanted to marry because blah, 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 whatever. And so they're saying instead he had to marry Princess Sophie. Okay. So there's Princess Sophie right here. Let me go ahead and click on Princess Sophie. Does anybody think that maybe Princess Sophie looks kind of manly? I'm just saying, there was a cute song that I posted about a couple weeks ago where it was like, why do all the royals look, why do all the women look like men? That was cute. That was actually the song. It was really a cute little song, but it's like, now that we're thinking about it, you know, you thought before maybe they were just not very, very feminine. But now I'm like, That's a man. That's a man right there. That's a man right there. Okay, so anyway, and then I wanted you to see the family line, and I don't know if I have this, you know, I had it pulled up. Yeah, here we go. I do have it. Here is the family line. So here you look at back in the 1700s, there's George the First. He was, that was King George the First through 1727. And then, so you just look at the highlighted in green, you'll see here George the Second, which is who we were, I guess, was it George or was it Third? No, I guess it was King George the Third. Okay, so it's George the Second in the that's basically probably when our forefathers came to America, and we said, we got to get away from these crazy people. And so, look, we'll have our own country. You stay over there. We'll stay here, and we'll, you know, catch you later. Anyway, here's George the Third. So he was ruling from 1760 to 1801. So he was our, yeah, that's that guy right there who was being so hateful to us. Does that say? That actually says King George the Second. Okay, now I'm already messing up the video. Uh-oh, I need to start over. All right, so either way, all these people, and I'm not trying to be an expert on these royal people, because they all are going to have to go to prison anyway. No, this is the Third. That is. I was right. I should trust myself. Anyway, so there's George the Third. That's the one during our, that we were trying to kick out. But the reality is, what we're finding out is that we've been fighting these people up until this day. These very same ones, we're still fighting to try to get out from under their boot on our throat. All right, so then if you, you know, scroll down, and you'll keep, you'll see the George the Fourth, and then William the Fourth, and then on you know, Edward the Seventh, and George the Fifth, and on it goes, Elizabeth the Second. Okay, that's the one that we've known about that just recently died. And then you've got, of course, King Charles the Third. So, you know, they just continue on and having, it's at different times more power over the world than at others. But you look at all throughout the world, and you'll see there's the Commonwealth of this and the Commonwealth of that. And there's basically all these British colonies. And the unfortunate truth is that we've been a British colony too, right? So that's what we have, you know, realized. And so that's what President Trump is up against, to get us free finally, once and for all, from these criminals that have usurped the throne. All right, so let's get started on, let's see if I get to the right thing. This is the video. This is, like I said, we did part one the other day. Now we're on part two. Really amazing, amazing information that was put out by the Lyndon LaRouche. And unfortunately, I don't think his channel is available at this point. I think that he is, he's gone on to be with the Lord. He's no longer with us. And so I'm afraid his channel, was infiltrated. And so I got this from Promethean, which I'm very, very thankful that they had. And they promoted, they said, everybody try to get this information out, because it really does connect so many dots. So that's what we're going to get started on right now. So this is part two. Let's jump in and let's make it happen. But someone playing the piano very badly, because, okay, let me just tell you why. They're not a bad piano player, I don't think. I think what they're trying to say is, you know, and again, you can go back and look at part one, what we did. I'll catch you up a little bit. What we were finding out is that we were being way too successful. Under Lincoln, he was, sharing all this great information about how to get out from under the boot of the imperialist, and not to be one of their colonies and be impoverished. And so it worked in America. And so they were doing this all over the world and being highly successful, and the imperialists were not happy about it. And so what are they going to do? They're going to kick over the game board, and they're just going to start a war. Hello. That's what they do, because they are pure evil. All right. So that's why they're playing that's why they're playing the piano badly, because they're trying to show that we're not, you know, this is going to be really bad news. And it was shocking that the whole world collapsed into this war, because they're really, really good at evil. They're really good at war. Okay, now, hopefully that helps.
the threatened world leadership of the British East India Company based itself on a relationship between control of the world's sea routes and enforced underdevelopment of interior land masses. The acquisition of strategic naval ports, or choke points, marked here in red, was the pivot of the system. By controlling these ports and corresponding sea lanes, the British dominated trade, using colonies such as India or African nations as sources of cheap raw materials and slave labor. Other nations wishing to engage in the same geographical area would have to operate through...
Before we go on, you see all those dots, those are the either the ports or the shipping lanes, and that they were utilizing what the imperialists, the royals, whatever you want to call them, were using to control trade all over the world and to keep everyone down. And if you wanted to do any transactions, you know, worldwide, you had to basically go through them. And if you didn't, then they would destroy your port. And so they protected these ports, and they destroyed other ports, so that it really made it impossible to get out from under their system. Okay. And they had the British fleet back in the day. And so then eventually, when we became a military power, then that enabled us to get out from under them, because they were not able to control the trade. But they found other ways, so we'll get to that. All right.
The British. The transcontinental rail projects of the post-Civil War period, therefore, emphasizing interior development of land masses, such as Lincoln's American Transcontinental, Sergei Vita's Trans-Siberian, and Bismarck's Berlin-Baghdad system, were a mortal threat to the historic maritime-based power of the British Empire.
We were aggressively promoting the American system, and the British at that point decided that the only thing that they could do to prevent the successful spread of the American system and the buildup of these rail connections and the land bridge across Eurasia was to blow up the world. Literally, they were losing the chess game badly, and so their only last option was to kick over the chessboard.
Under this geopolitical view, British imperial policy toward the end of the 19th century turned to the creation of a great world war, pivoted on pitting Russia and Germany against each other. The intention of this policy was not for any nation to come out as the victor, but rather for all nations involved to be destroyed. In Germany, Bismarck was conscious of this geopolitical strategy. In correspondence, he wrote about his nightmare of coalitions, that alliance of France, Russia, and Britain, which would encircle Germany and destroy her in war and economic ruin.
Bismarck was committed to alliances which allowed for Germany to develop, but he also understood that these alliances required the benefit of the other. That is, that the unification of Germany occurred in a war against France and Austria. But he was willing to form an alliance with Austria. He had his own alliance with France, because he realized that if he were at war with these countries, Germany wouldn't be able to develop. So his commitment to the Three Kaiser League, the alliance with Russia, the alliance with Austria, that wasn't popular with some of the smaller German states that were incorporated in Germany. But Bismarck's argument was that this policy created the best potential for Germany to develop its industry, to increase its markets, and to have peace.
He also negotiated with the Russian Tsar, secretly, behind the back of his own Kaiser, because the Kaiser was going to agree with the Kaiser of Austria, this old fart there, still the emperor, in a Balkan war. And the Balkan War involved Slavic peoples, which were part of the Orthodox Church network, as the Russians were part of the Orthodox network. So it was an attempt by the British to organize another religious war between Orthodox and others, Western and Eastern Christianity. He knew you don't do that. So he entered into a secret agreement, he did, behind the back of his Kaiser, two Kaisers, the first Kaiser and the second one, Wilhelm I and Wilhelm II, who was a completely British fool, and said that he would sabotage any attempt to support Austria in a Balkan war. So as long as he was in power, the war couldn't go off, because the British plan was to have Russia and France attack Germany at the same time, and to use the Habsburg-Balkan War as a trigger for that purpose. So no, sabotage it.
Bismarck's insight and diplomatic skill thwarted all British attempts to pit Germany against Russia in war. His understanding of how European powers were manipulated by the British and his counter-policy of alliances with nations for peace meant that for a British-orchestrated world war to succeed, Bismarck had to be eliminated. During these years...
Okay, so it's the same thing. I just wanted you to see... You might have never even heard of Bismarck. I don't think before I had heard of Bismarck, really, maybe just in passing, and to see what a key role he had played and how they absolutely hated him because he was onto their game and he was able to play this 5D chess like President Trump and get around what they were trying to do to control their manufacturing and their trade, as well as trying to force all these wars. So he's working, you know, for really, to be honest, he was working for everybody, every country, to have the freedom, just like President Trump is now. Really, it's very, very, very similar. Anyway, I appreciate what he tried to do, but of course they're gonna eliminate him. Same thing that they're gonna do here in a little bit. We're gonna talk about how they did this with McKinley. And of course, with Lincoln, anyone who was onto their game and figured out a way around their system was eliminated.
Prince Edward Albert, the protege of Lord Palmerston and the son of Queen Victoria, made himself dictator of British foreign policy. For the next 20 years, he would personally oversee the elimination of all obstacles to the creation of a nightmare of coalitions, beginning with Otto von Bismarck. His greatest weapon in his work was not the gunboat, but insight into turning the vices and weaknesses of individuals into the most destructive weapons against them. The removal of Bismarck began with the use of one of Edward's greatest allies, his in-depth knowledge of the personal defects of his nephew, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany.
Edward Albert, and partly is able to operate through this insane oligarchical royal family system, where, you know, the Tsar of Russia, the Kaiser of Germany, they're all part of his family. They're all offshoots of Queen Victoria. You know, when you think of an oligarchy, you kind of think of a termite mound with the queen termite, this gigantic blob about 20 times the size of her consort, pumping out eggs. And every other termite is there to aid the queen in her eggs.
When you have a bunch of noblemen who intermarry, you have family connections, but you also weaken the bloodline, so to speak. And so you had these figures like Kaiser William II, very inferior intellect, very much influenced by the pomp and circumstance of the empire. Kaiser William II, I think in 15 years, had 37 design changes in the costumes of the Imperial Guard. He loved parades, but he was also desirous of flattery. He was very insecure. And so a court around him started saying from the moment he emerged, you can't be like Frederick the Great, his ancestor, if you have a Bismarck running policy.
Under orders from Prince Edward Albert, Kaiser Wilhelm ousted Bismarck from the German chancellorship in 1890. This event marked the beginning of World War I. The long fuse of the British Empire's attack on the American system was now lit. After his ouster, Bismarck foretold the great coming war.
For my part, I am no longer under any obligations towards the personalities now in office or towards my successor. All the bridges have been broken down. The tide, which used to connect us with Russia, has been severed. Personal authority and confidence are lacking in Berlin. If the country is well ruled, the coming war may be averted. If it is badly ruled, that war may become a 7 years war.
Prince Edward Albert and his sycophants now unleashed hell on earth. The nightmare coalition of Russia, France, and Britain, which Bismarck had worked to prevent, Edward now sought to create. Every nation in Europe and Asia which had responded to the United States' successes would be targeted for destruction.
All right, I want to catch you up, make sure that we're on the same page on all this. So this is the same thing that they've done every time. You know, when the amazing thing is, after Lincoln died, it actually did not fall apart, and they didn't start another war. No one was interested in having any more wars after the Civil War. But, you know, this, what it's just showing here in this picture, that now that Bismarck was removed, then they unleashed hell on earth, and this is exactly what's unfortunately happened to Germany. They were just way too powerful. They were way too successful, and they had to be stopped. And so anyone who had joined with them, America, doing these trade negotiations and trade deals, they were going to be, quote, punished and made an example of, and say, look, we're never going to allow you to do this ever again. All right. The other thing I want you to notice is, of course, that they used this weak-minded person who couldn't think for himself and did not recognize the genius and the skill of Bismarck. And so, and of course, this guy, you know, he's probably scared for his own life too, because he realizes how powerful these people are. And so he ended up, easily being swayed. And that's what happens is, you know, these secret societies, you know, have infiltrated every town. They've infiltrated every organization. They're in there finding out what's the skinny, who are the weaklings, who are the weak-minded ones, who are the ones we want to put in these positions of power so that we can wield this power through them. And that's really what the white horse is about, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. If you're not familiar with that, in my book, End Times in a Thousand Years of Peace, I go into what is the four horsemen. And the white one, this is my main book, End Times in a Thousand Years of Peace. In this book, I talk about the four horsemen. The white horse is the puppet leaders. And that's what this Kaiser person was. And many times they use something even more nefarious, like their weakness about some kind of pedophilia or, you know, whatever, and blackmail them. Okay, so they have lots of different ways that they can get control of people, put them in a position of power, and use them to wield the power. All right, so I want you to see now everyone is going to go and fall into World War One and end up being, all of this torment throughout the world. So check this out.
In 1894, French President Sadi Carnot was assassinated. Edward's Anglophile circles within the weakened French government then launched the Dreyfus scandal. This involved the fraudulent conviction of French army captain Alfred Dreyfus, of Jewish-German descent, as a traitor. This scandal would continue for 12 years, giving birth to an anti-German and anti-Semitic right-wing turn in France. Temporarily overcoming his known disdain for the yellow races, Edward Albert and his sons, through continuous official visits to Japan, personally organized the brainwashing of the Emperor Meiji of Japan. Albert, as he had also done with Wilhelm, preyed on Japan's island mythology. You are an island in Asia, just as we are an island in Europe. As we rule over Europe, you shall rule over Asia. With England's help, Japan will become a great naval power. Under this direction, Japan launched war against China in 1894, using its largely British-built navy, and grabbing huge tracts of Chinese territory where U.S. and Russian industrialists had hoped to build critical links for the Trans-Siberian rail line. Although the advances achieved in the wake of Lincoln's Civil War victory were being quickly crushed in Europe and Asia, the United States remained at this time a stronghold of power and independence against the British Empire. Under newly elected president and Lincoln devotee William McKinley, economic and political progress were charging forward. McKinley's commitment to the continuation of the U.S. policy against free trade were more explicit than any United States president had ever made them.
30 years of protection has brought us to the first rank in agriculture, in mining, and in manufacturing development. We lead all nations in these three great departments of industry. We have outstripped even the United Kingdom, which had centuries the start of us. Her fiscal policy for 50 years past has been the free trade revenue tariff policy of the Democrats. Ours, for 31 years, the protective tariff policy of the Republicans. Tried by any test, measured by any standard.
All right, so I want you to see that picture and make sure you understand what they're showing here. This picture right here that I can't get to, there you go. This one right here is basically showing that if you do what they call free trade, remember I talked about this on the video last time, free trade is not, that's the term they use for it, but the real meaning of it is that it's It's where they would just make everyone have slave wages, where you just, you know, you sell your goods, you work really hard, make all of your goods, and you sell them very, very low prices. Whereas here on the right, you've got, everyone's doing really well. They've got plenty for their family. And so it's that, he's calling that protection. And what he means is protection for the worker to make sure that they are not being mistreated and treated as a slave, like slave labor in China or what has happened in America. And really, you know, unfortunately, you know, it's resorted to that until President Trump. And that's what really is happening right now with all these tariffs that President Trump is invoking and all these trade negotiations where he's cutting out the middleman of the imperialists. And that's why they are desperate to stop him. And thank God they've not been able to. So this is the same thing McKinley was doing. McKinley was an amazing businessman, much like President Trump. He knew how to help everyone to succeed. And he was doing it, but they're going to, unfortunately, stop him.
Measured by any standard, we lead all the rest of the world. Protection had vindicated itself.
McKinley immediately adopted a tariff policy, a protectionist policy, that had the British freaked out. In fact, the British sent key operatives over to the United States to work in 1896 in the campaign against McKinley.
McKinley's election was a major obstacle to the British Empire's promotion of free trade and war. In an explicit revival of John Quincy Adams' Monroe Doctrine policy, McKinley embraced the International American Conference's proposal for extension of the U.S. railway system through Mexico to the tip of South America. This project, if completed in conjunction with the Russian plans for a Bering Strait rail link, would make it possible by the beginning of the 20th century to travel from Western Europe to the southern cone of the Western Hemisphere by rail. Wow. But when McKinley's vice president died in 1899, British Allied bankers seized the opportunity. Teddy Roosevelt was forced on as McKinley's new vice president for the next election. Teddy Roosevelt was as far as one could get from a Lincoln Republican. A sworn Anglophile, his love for the British Empire and its system of racial hierarchy were due to two key individuals. One was his uncle, James Dunwoody Bullock, who, during the Civil War, had served in England as the head of the Confederate Secret Service. Bullock procured the entire Confederate Navy, which destroyed Union ships and blockades of the South, prolonging the war. Teddy Roosevelt considered Bullock one of his personal heroes and traveled to meet his exiled uncle in England in 1886 to be tutored on naval war strategy. American traitor Alfred Thayer Mahan, author of The Influence of Sea Power on History, was the other major influence on Teddy Roosevelt. Mahan frequented the Royal Societies and clubs of Prince Edward Albert's England, promoting their new post-Civil War vision of an Anglo-American naval empire.
Mahan's leading proponent in the United States was Theodore Roosevelt. When Mahan's book was published, very few people read it. Roosevelt bought up as many copies as he could and distributed it throughout the Congress, to the Navy, to key people.
McKinley continued to organize the transcontinental rail projects despite Teddy Roosevelt and his British allies in the White House. 6 months into his second term, he delivered a rousing speech to the Pan American Conference in Buffalo to 50,000 North and South Americans.
Okay, before we get into that, did you guys know that? I don't think they ever told us that in school, and I don't guess I ever really researched it, but yeah, that Teddy Roosevelt, you know, all I knew about him is that he was this great conservationist, and his face is on Mount Rushmore, and he must have been such a great president, right? That's what I was thinking, not so much. So he was one of them. And so I haven't really researched what happened to McKinley's vice president, but he had an untimely death. And so then, of course, they plug Theodore Roosevelt right into that position. And he has family members who are exiled, actually, but, you know, in England, how bad did they have to be? So they were, but he learned all of the tricks of the trade, so to speak. And so he was very useful in this position. Well, not long afterward, you're going to see that McKinley is going to be shot. And that's when Theodore Roosevelt ascended to being the president. So there you go. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound a little bit like, you know, what happened with JFK and Lyndon Johnson rising into that position? And he was not someone Johnson was not someone that Kennedy had wanted to be as his vice president. I mean, imagine if you're a president and you have a vice president who is a scoundrel, you're just, you know, counting your days, right? Anyway, so McKinley was still, though, working so hard to help the industry in our country, and they were just chomping at the bit to get rid of him.
The next day, McKinley was murdered by an anarchist, deployed by the same Emma Goldman anarchist networks which had killed President Carnot of France 7 years previous. As Goldman would later admit, it was London that was the base of operations for her international terrorist movement.
The killing of McKinley, which was done by the British, was done by, but it was to get rid of him. He brought in Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt was the trained by his uncle, who was the chief of the Confederate Intelligence Service in London, as a British agent. So you have the presidency of the United States, by assassination, is turned over from a patriot to an enemy, Teddy Roosevelt.
This derailment of the Lincoln legacy in the United States ensured that Edward Albert, now King Edward VII, would meet no resistance from the U.S. In 1904, by preying on the continuing Germanophobia connected to the Dreyfus Affair and a humiliating defeat of the French army by the British at Fashoda, Edward and his French agents rammed through the Entente Cordiale agreement with France. The pivot of this friendship treaty included binding commitments for collaboration in future war. On the other side of Eurasia, Britain's other new subject, Japan, was poised to launch another war, this time against Russia.
Okay, before we go on to that, I just wanted to just bring up that President Trump is doing all of this at the same time, which it has to be. But not only is he doing the trade negotiations, but along with it, he's saying, you know, that along with the trade negotiations, you have to agree that we're not going to have war because, you know, we're going to work out our differences. We're going to work everything out. And if someone is not, you know, following, you know, what is fair for everyone, then they will not be able to trade. If they're going to start wars, then they won't be able to trade. So that's how he is doing this. And so opposite of how they were doing it, where they were making all these alignments with other countries and forcing them to come into a war. Oh, if you've got, if someone attacks us, then you have to join in with us. So it was just one little match could start a huge powder keg of a world war. All right. So then let's go on to Japan.
The Japanese emperor had signed an Anglo-Japan treaty in 1902, the central feature being that in the event of a Japanese-Russian war, Britain would prevent other European powers from aiding in Russia's defense. With the green light thus on, British banks had increased loans to Japan for arms and warship production. As the Entente Cordiale was being finalized, Japan launched a devastating sneak attack on the Russian naval station of Port Arthur, foreshadowing the Pearl Harbor attack 37 years later against the United States. By 1905, the Japanese war against Russia had achieved its objective. The Russian nation was crippled. Only one capital ship remained in its navy. The resources of the country were exhausted. After the peace treaty, arbitrated by U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt, a revolution was run against the Tsar, further weakening his ability to govern. The optimistic vision of Russian leaders like Sergei Vita for a tramway of iron rail girding the world had been replaced by the bleak practicalities of war and British balance of power games. Shortly thereafter, King Edward bestowed the most noble British order of knighthood, the Royal Order of the Garter, on the Japanese emperor, an order so esteemed it was only possessed by the king and 25 knights around him. The summer of that year, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany and Tsar Nicholas II of Russia met on a yacht in the Baltic Sea.
The Tsar feels a deep personal anger at England and the king. He called Edward VII the greatest mischief-maker and the most dangerous and deceptive intriguer in the world. I could only agree with him, adding that I especially had to suffer from his intrigues in recent years. He has a passion for plotting against every power of making a little agreement, whereupon the Tsar interrupted me, striking the table with his fist and saying, "Well, I can only say he shall not get one from me, and never in my life against Germany or you. My word of honor upon it."
Tsar Nicholas of Russia would not keep his word of honor for long. Within 2 years of this discussion, in 1907, the Tsar signed a war alliance with King Edward's Britain, arranging Russia in a triple partnership with France and Britain against Wilhelm's Germany. the very trap Nicholas had sworn to his cousin he would avoid. In the absence of Otto von Bismarck, no one remained to prevent King Edward's orchestration of a nightmare of coalitions for war. Coincident to arranging this series of horrifying developments, King Edward VII was maintaining perhaps the warmest correspondence between an English monarch and a U.S. president in history. Edward wrote Teddy letters about how the two of them had been placed in command of the two great branches of the Anglo-Saxon race, while Teddy responded that the real interests of the English-speaking peoples are one, alike in the Atlantic and the Pacific. As president, Teddy Roosevelt shut down McKinley's Pan-American Rail Project. He created East India Company-inspired conservation parks, denying settlers access to land intended by Lincoln for development. And he walked softly with a big stick all over the Monroe Doctrine, turning the U.S. from the leading enemy of empire in the Western Hemisphere to its leading friend.
All right, all right. So it's just everything is poised for war, and you see how they're using these puppets to foment all these wars, and they just find people who will do their bidding. And they're really, really good at it. And you see how between Russia and Germany, how even though he was adamant, you could tell he was adamant about it. And so it really doesn't go into detail here, but they just found a way to cause the whole thing to break down. And it's really shocking. But like I said, they're very, very good at doing all of this this evil. Again, that just really points out for us what an amazing thing President Trump is doing. I don't think most people have any clue, you know, how complicated this is, that what he's doing. All right, so let's move toward what happened with Theodore Roosevelt. Of course, McKinley is dead. So what does Theodore Roosevelt do? Immediately, he stops all the wonderful things that McKinley was doing to help to grow the economy, to help people to succeed, to help build up the American infrastructure, and you know, change. And he, walking softly and carrying a big stick, basically, he was making sure that the empire, the British Empire, was getting the benefit of the American workers' labor on what they all call free trade. So he pushed for that. He stopped this transcontinental railroad, to Panama, all this that McKinley had set up to do, to be helpful and to promote peace and to promote fair trade. He immediately stopped because he was, an imperialist at heart, that he wanted to have the haves and the have-nots. And yeah, and at the end of this video, I think it's on the one we'll do next time, the third installment, what's so crazy is they're so greedy. They want to take, yes, they've taken billions. They've taken all this wealth, no doubt a lot of money. But the honest truth is allow people to be free to use their skills and do work and have the benefit of their work, they'd probably make 10 times more. But it's not really about the money. It's not really about the money. It's about they've made a deal with the devil, and literally, and that they are bound and determined to destroy humanity, and that's their glee. They get glee out of not that they need more money, but that they want us to have less and for us to suffer. And that sounds crazy for normal people, but that is what they really do. They really do want in their heart. Okay, not that it's really a heart, but anyway. Okay, so now let's learn more about the truth about Theodore Roosevelt. Did you guys know any of this? Yeah.
With the post-Civil War power of the U.S. thus chained to British interest, the last fateful steps to the ignition of war were lit in the Balkans.
What the British want to do is take an area where there's a confluence of division. You have Roman Catholic, Serbian, or the Orthodox churches. You have some Muslim elements. It's all the leftovers of the Ottoman Empire and the conflicts of the Ottoman Empire. And the British view is we can foment conflict virtually at the drop of a hat in these places.
In June of 1914, the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, Archduke Ferdinand, rode through Sarajevo, Bosnia, and was assassinated by an anarchist. Predictably, The Austrians reacted by declaring war on Serbia. Tsar Nicholas II mobilized to defend the Serbs, and so likewise the German, French, and British entered the conflict. The Great War, whose fuse had been burning since King Edward's ouster of Chancellor Bismarck, went off.
Indeed, the war just started because the war started. There was no reason for this war to start. Everything was in place. There was a buildup of conflict. Every side was building up more of their military capability. Orders were going out. And at a certain point, the armies were on the move and nothing could stop them. And war broke out. But this was a British plan to set this in motion.
This is what happens when you have inadequate leadership. William II was a terrible emperor in Germany. Nicholas, Tsar Nicholas of Russia, was an incompetent. The French government was incapable of addressing the broader strategic questions. They were all putty in the hands of the British manipulators. The British wanted World War I to destroy continental Europe. And you look at the incredible numbers of people who died on the battlefields fighting over a couple of square miles of land. And you see what a tragedy is about.
But really, the key to this is Europe is destroyed and demoralized. Because the idea is, how did this happen to us? We're supposed to be civilized. We have science. We have parliamentary democracies. We have culture. And we engage in a meat grinder where people were slaughtered over inches of ground for 4 years. And nothing could stop it. And this is a war that was fought for no reason. People really know that.
In 1915, President Woodrow Wilson brought the United States into the war on the side of the British Empire. An avid Ku Klux Klan supporter, Wilson's election had been made possible by Teddy Roosevelt, who ran a third-party Bull Moose ticket in 1912, spitting enough votes from incumbent Republican William Taft to secure Wilson's victory.
Under somebody like McKinley or his successors, the U.S. probably would have stayed out. But under Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, both with a history tied to the Confederacy, the United States ultimately comes in on the British side.
And so that's really what it's about, is it once they install their puppet leaders in all these positions, then it's just a matter of their timing. Okay, let's go ahead and pull the trigger. It's really not, it really has not been complicated or difficult for them to start these wars. They start them just at any moment that they please, as long as they have their people in these positions of power. And what's amazing is things can be set right very quickly when you have the right person in power, like President Trump stopping 8 wars in 8 months. McKinley doing all these great things, it's really amazing. And it's not so different from the Old Testament. If you read 1 Kings and 2 Kings, let me just boil it down for you. You'd have a good king, and everything would be at peace, and everyone would have all the things that they need, and then you'd have a bad king. There'd be war and lack. So it's the same types of thing that went on back in the day. So that's what they're focusing on, is getting their puppet leaders installed. That's why it's so important, that we get our free and fair elections, so that we do control that, as well as our free speech, so that we can help people understand who. What the issues are and who to vote for. But I just think this is an amazing video, because it really helps you to piece together our history and what has been going on. So, yeah, check it out.
And it becomes a decisive factor.
The 24-year-long orchestration of World War I by King Edward VII thoroughly shattered the possibility of ending the British Empire. In Europe and Asia, each nation which had embraced the American system in the wake of Lincoln's assassination had been roped into destroying itself. In the United States, the Lincoln legacy was all but lost, with Woodrow Wilson closely tying the U.S. to support of British imperial interest for the post-war world. The British Empire itself, now more in control of world politics than possibly ever before, positioned itself to eradicate the potential for the Lincoln legacy to arise again by moving for the permanent eradication of sovereign nation states. For this, the deceased Edward VII's policy of steering nations into self-destructive conflict with one another would be continued, but around new figures such as H.G. Wells, who had served as the director of British intelligence during World War I. Wells and his collaborators began immediately to sow the seeds for another great war, this one to wipe away nations and pave the way for world government.
Wells was a particularly nasty, evil, but very intelligent guy. And so in both his literary writings, his novels, his short stories, and then in his non-literary, non-fiction writing, particularly his Open Conspiracy. What Wells laid out is the idea that you have to create world government, world empire under British domination.
This is an independent sovereign state.
Yes, we must talk about that.
We don't discuss it.
We don't approve of independent sovereign states.
You don't approve?
We mean to stop them.
That's war,
if you will.
Well, I think we know how we stand.
The British foreign policy for Germany in the post-war period reflected the exact aims of Wells's policy. The Versailles Treaty of 1919, imposing nearly all of the post-war reparations on Germany, meant an undoing of all of Bismarck's previous successes and a dissolution of Germany as a sovereign country. At gunpoint, the most productive agricultural lands and natural resources were seized. Ships, locomotives, and half of the nation's gold reserves were taken away. Social programs were eliminated, industries privatized, and vicious waves of speculation unleashed on the Deutschmark. The Reichsbank desperately printed mountains of currency in the vain hope of covering the unpayable debt, leading to the hyperinflation crisis of 1923. The British had finally reconquered Germany. In Southwest Asia, the same policy was pursued. Secret negotiations of the British Arab Bureau and French Foreign Ministry had created the Sykes-Picot Accord, which mandated British control of the Palestine, Transjordan, and Iraq region, and French control of Lebanon and Syria. Still to this day, the manipulation of religious and ethnic tensions to create wars in this region echoes back to this repositioning of empire.
Okay, do you see that, you guys? You see over here Iraq and it's controlled by the British, Palestine British, you've got the Syria is French, Lebanon is French, and you, of course, they're using that to at the drop of a hat, they can foment a war, as well as all the different, you know, religious issues. It's not about the religion. They care nothing about the religion. They just want to use it for their own evil purposes, right? And so the same thing happened in Palestine. They established this state. Let's see, the Balfour Declaration was 13. Was it anyway? Right around the same time as Woodrow Wilson, and this was established so that they could use this as a way to, you know, foment war, gain territory, gain power, etc. So that's the whole name of the game. We know who our enemy is. Putin knows who our enemy is. Xi knows who our enemy is. You know, all the world leaders know who is the one that is we have to stop. And so that's the great thing is finally everyone is on the same page. It is not as easy as it sounds like it should be, because here we are 8 years in and we still have not yet been able to finally defeat them, because they've dug in their heels and they've infiltrated so many things, organizations and governments all over the world. So anyway, but that I thought that was really, really helpful to see how, the level of infiltration and just all that they had done to Germany, and that they used this, to punish them. It's just, it's awful, awful what's happened to Germany. Just so you know, Germany is, the way their name derived from Germain, as which means the true, and I believe it's really from the, E. Raymond Kapp talked about this in his book, Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets, where those are the true true Israelites. They had not been, married, intermarried, and so they truly were like true Israelites who, worshiped the Lord and according to the Old Testament. And so, they weren't, like half Israelite and half something else. They were Israelites who were basically married to Israelites back in the day when the name was originally called Germany. And so I think that's one of the reasons that they were attacked. Is the only reason I bring that up is because I think that's why they were attacked, because they have such a strong culture and of being strong. And you can see that exactly what happened is with Bismarck rising to power and how quickly they rose. Same thing in America. We have this amazing destiny in America. And so, unfortunately for them, they were not able to stop us. But good for us, they haven't. We've been able to make inroads. Now, the other thing is, it's what's shocking to me, really, it's 100 years later, they were saying that they wanted to have a new world order, and they still haven't been able to do it. They're saying, okay, now is the time. We're going to go ahead and have world domination, like the Saturday morning cartoon. We're going to take over the world. I mean, even as a kid, I'm watching these Saturday morning cartoons. I'm like, why do you want to do that? You know, I don't understand why that's a thing. Anyway, so that's what they were trying to do even back in the day, 100 years ago, basically around the time of the World War I, and they have not been able to do it. So that tells you that this is... It's not been easy for them to accomplish either, even with all their power. So, all right, check it out.
In the United States, the same banks and cartels dismantling the German nation positioned themselves for similar actions against the already weakened American system. J.P. Morgan's bank, located at 23 Wall Street, had been established as the American arm of a British bank and steered as an insurrection into American finance since the 1860s. By the 1920s, the House of Morgan operated more akin to a cartel than a bank, with no public function and a board which reached into thousands of American companies, industries, and utilities. The hand of Morgan was known to be monarchical in the land of American finance, only subsumed in power by the British Empire he was acting for. It was this vast financial network which would take over the political parties, install a series of London and Wall Street-controlled presidents like Calvin Coolidge, and advise the dismantling of the American system. By 1928, John J. Raskob, a J.P. Morgan asset who had built his fortune through insider speculation, rose to prominence in the Democratic Party. Raskob lent the bankrupt Democratic Party more than $300,000, nearly erasing their debt. Raskob was then appointed chair of the Democratic National Committee, where he exerted powerful influence over the party's politics. Controlling things on the Republican side of the aisle was another J.P. Morgan agent, Thomas Lamont. Lamont was a financial liaison to both Imperial Japan and Mussolini's Italy. In 1925, when Mussolini's party was nearly bankrupt, Lamont came in with $100 million of J.P. Morgan money to bail him out. This same Thomas Lamont also provided daily consultation to the U.S. President Herbert Hoover. In October of 1929, the rampant speculation of the 1920s culminated in Black Friday.
It was the 1920 line collapse. And it collapsed amidst a period of dominated by euphoria. Oh, you can't beat the system. This is our system. Everything is fine. You can't beat the system. So like the boomers today, can't beat the system. Well, we go along with it. That's the system. We learn to live with the system. We learn within the system. We adapt to the system. We're going to be successful. We're going to make it.
The financial crash on Wall Street spread throughout the economy as a whole. And so you had not only massive unemployment through the collapse of the entire industrial and agricultural base of the economy. But you really were headed into the direction of real social despair bordering on social chaos.
Well, the shock was great. But then 1930, 31, 32, and 33, it was a horrible nightmare for them. People, you'd see them, the crowds waiting on the soup kitchens to eat breakfast in Manhattan. Lined up, dressed of people who had been considered themselves well-to-do in the previous time. Now they are with their top hats, their suits, and so forth. They're out there in the street, perfectly begging for a meal.
Look, this was a very dangerous period. This was the period when there was an effort by the Morgan interest to put a fascist government in power in France around Pierre Laval. This was the period of the Spanish Revolution when the fascist regime of Franco was put in. Hitler was in power. Mussolini was in power. There was a pro-fascist movement in Britain centered around Lord Beaverbrook, which was moving to take over Great Britain. And there were bankers on Wall Street who supported this, including the grandfather of our current president. Prescott Bush was working through the Harriman interests to fund Hitler.
Through these networks and directed on the ground by Reich Bank President Hjalmar Schacht, millions of dollars were injected into the Nazi Party. By January, German President Hindenburg was pressured to put Hitler in as the chancellor, and by February 27, 1933, the Reichstag building was set on fire by a Nazi party member. The Nazis blamed this on the Communist Party and then used the fear inspired by the events as a pretext to give Hitler emergency dictatorial powers. The economic crash in the United States had snowballed into widespread hunger, bankruptcy, foreclosures, and 25% unemployment. People were not in a position to pay attention to the ominous rumblings abroad. Yet interest in the coming elections was unprecedented. Voters fervently hoped to find a leader who would, against all odds, turn them away from despair and restore the nation to prosperity. As the Democratic Convention neared, the Raskob-directed Democratic National Committee would go to extraordinary lengths to win the presidency belt. The party rules at the time were that the candidate to be nominated needed two-thirds of the delegates to win, and he could win. The method was flexible until the delegates would break form and the convention might end up in a deadlock where the party would elect a compromise candidate of the DNC's.
Acceptable as long as it wasn't Franklin Roosevelt.
Their idea was that if they could string it out through four, five, six, seven, or eight ballots, that they could eventually convince supporters of Roosevelt that he couldn't make it, they should drop their support for him, and they could bring in a candidate acceptable to the Morgans.
To ensure none of the delegates broke for Roosevelt, his opponents created a chaotic atmosphere at the name was mentioned. They then went to the extent of pressuring Roosevelt's delegates to break from him while they ate at restaurants. Roosevelt did not get enough. Campaign manager Howe and Roosevelt both knew that if at any point he lost votes,
Roosevelt's in direct communication with Howe and Farley,
and to delegates,
a quiet conviction that the
that moralized
a majority of the convention, my friends will not, and to stand fast and win.
All right. So that was basically a lot of the machinations that were happening at the convention. But bottom line, we've got now Franklin Delano Roosevelt coming in, and he understood what the British Empire was up, what they were doing, and what he would be up against. So he was really God's man for that very hour. As we was just talking about, J.P. Morgan was the British hand who was controlling the money system in our country, in a huge, huge control over our industry, and really, as you see, they could easily just at the drop of a hat cause this collapse of our financial system, and the people who had formerly been very well to do were in breadlines. So they clearly did this on purpose again to try to, first of all, because they love to cause all the mayhem, and also to try to prevent us from doing anything to stop them, what they were doing in Europe and all the rest of the world. So they were busy about it, weren't they? And what they didn't expect was for the Lord to raise up Roosevelt. So that's going to be on our next video, talking about what happened with him. And it was really very, very amazing. And I guess I just thought that Roosevelt and Teddy Roosevelt were of the same thought pattern, but clearly they were not. They're very, very, really polar opposites. And I guess you saw also the money people, giving all this money, but there are strings attached, and that's of course what they do even to this day. And so that's one of the big problems that we faced. All right, I think that's everything for this one. It's really, really. I hope you really are enjoying this, because this is really connecting the dots for me. I hope it's connecting the dots for you to really understand who we've been fighting all this time and who President Trump is fighting. And we will win this time. So let's pray. Again, thank you, Lord, for what you have done in our country, raising our country up for this great destiny. And thank you for the wonderful people that you've put in positions all throughout our time so that that they would not be able to stop America. And nothing can stop what is coming, because this is your plan and this is your destiny for us, and that we will be your Omer, the blessing bundle of grain that will save the world, and that we will you will use us to do this job. Thank you for raising us up in this day. We are part of your plan, and we're just so honored to be part of it. And thank you for our wonderful president and all those who are working on the front lines and fighting so hard for our country. We give you thanks and praise that you are perfect in all your ways, and all wise and all knowing and all good, and that this is for the good of humanity, that we will enter into your kingdom. We pray all this in your wonderful name, King Jesus. Amen. All right, guys, I love you. I'll see you on the next one. But yeah, I wanted to show you also, in case you haven't read this one yet, this is now available, The Golden Age, about this wonderful future that we're headed into once we get these creeps out of here, and you're going to love it. It's really so such great news about all that God has promised to us for this day, what we're going to enjoy. All right, I think that's everything. I'll go ahead and play one little quick song, and then we are going to jet. That's not it. That's my school board stuff. All right, guys, I love you, and I will talk to you later.
Your shine. The Lord is at the head of the column. He leads them with a shout. This is His mighty army, and they follow His orders.